exactly.
You want me to call you Anthony? You want me to call you Cone?
Anthony's great. Anthony's great.
And I'm going to get started because I'm tired of waiting on Kaiser, and he's got to figure out a way to get in the building.
Let's do it.
All right, we're joined by Anthony, who's in charge of volleyball performance at SMU. We're excited to have him. I know he's got a lot of Texas ties and is a busy man, and our internet stalking, man. I love people that love to do podcasts because they like sharing information. They don't feel like they have secrets and they invented stuff. And I enjoyed listening to a lot of yours and assigned some of these interns to listen. And just, I guess it all started. I followed you on Instagram and I was like, one, he's posting great content, not just silly stuff. And it's different. Some of the eccentrics, I hadn't seen weight releasers outside of powerlifting ever, really. So, and, you know, the partials. And I was, man, I got to get a hold of Anthony and talk with him. And this is a great opportunity. So we appreciate your time, Coach, and we're glad.
Thank you. This is great.
Yeah. And then I'm filling in for Brock Calvillo. He's going under weather. We got Blake Wilson, got Ashley Easley, and then Kaiser Decker will be in because it is intern chit chat. I'm helping guide it, but I thought what a great opportunity for young minds to learn from your experience. So I'm gonna start it off, man. Strength conditioning, nuts and bolts kind of segment. Help me. I'm so naive and uneducated. Squat wedges. That's what I call them. What do you call them?
Yeah. Squat wedge, slant board. It's all the same thing.
I've never used them. Tell me what I'm missing out on.
Yeah, I think like in this time of college athletics, like the time to develop has become so small with the transfer portal. And so any way to amplify the process of learning, like a skill, like a squat, for example, any tool that can help us. And that's, I think, our go-to. Like, I feel like for most people, just elevating the heels to keep their center of mass under them, like it makes a life-changing difference, like immediately. And then for us, like with how we're squatting, very like classic Olympic style, upright torso, a lot of knee flexion, a little more narrow than traditional squatting maybe, because we're trying to bias the quads for us as the main driver as the squat. So with that, like you need knee flexion to use the quads, and again, elevating that heel, because usually the lack of knee flexion is probably going to come from the lack of the ankle to be able to dorsiflex. It probably can, but then like your center of mass gets behind you and it gets really awkward. So it just kind of band-aids all those things, you know, without having to like directly target like ankle mobility or like it just amplifies that process to get us to point A to point B a lot faster without all the stuff in between. So for how we're squatting, very Olympic style, it just gets us to that point a lot faster.
Do you ever squat without them or no?
I mean, only when we're like for the partials, for example, you know, anything when we're, if it involves like full knee flexion, we'll use it. I mean, we'll move kids down to where it's maybe they're just like an inch max off of the, on the heel wedge. And it's just like a slight elevation, very similar to like a weightlifting shoe in a sense, like we'll move them down pretty shallow and vice versa. We'll move kids really high up at full foot. It just becomes very relative to the individual and like what we're trying to accomplish. But I haven't gotten to the point like where I feel really comfortable moving kids down flat and the squat looking the same as if they're on the heel.
Are they, again, I'm showing you how uneducated I am on these, do you have them where they're adjustable or do you have to have multiple like plyo boxes? Here's the 8-inch wedge.
Yeah, so we have, I feel like the sweet spot is like a 20-degree slant board. And the 20-degree is like when you're fully full foot flat. And obviously, as you work down that slant board with how much foot you're putting on, that angle is going to change and get more shallow. So, for example, if it's like just a kid's half a heel on that slant board, it might be like 5 to 10 degrees, you know, versus when the full foot is up is 20 degrees. I think any more than 20 is too much. And then I think any less than 20, like for some people, it's not enough, you know. So it's that right in that sweet spot where you can walk them up and down for the individual and you don't need any more than that.
If you didn't have the wedges, would, you know, back in the old day, I guess people used 10-pound plates. Is that?
Yep. Same thing. Like for example, our Olympic weight room, we share like a court sport weight room. So our Olympic side has no slant boards. So for like in the summer when we're in that space, like I'll take them over. But like if we didn't have them, and we've had that in the past, like we have 5-10s under the heels, same thing.
Awesome. I feel this is why we do this now. I know, and I'd like to kind of get one and just experiment myself with it or with a small group for sure. Weight releasers, what got you started on them? There, you had to have seen some kind of powerlifting, old, maybe even black and white kind of Russian video to even know what one of those is.
Yeah, I had somebody do that for me on the front end. So when I was at Houston with Alan Bishop, that was when I was first introduced to it. And he was starting to like dabble and like get working into like how to integrate it within the team dynamic. Obviously, it's really easy to go individually, like, but with a team, like, and it's a complicated like apparatus. So that was my first experience with it. And then from there, like understanding where it came from, like the people that made it happen. So before Bishop, Christian Thibodeau, it's like where I went down the rabbit hole with like a periodization programming weight releasers. And then even farther back, you know, like you can probably find some crazy Soviet literature, I'm sure. Bob Hoffman back in like way back in the day, like again, early powerlifting, like York barbell, that kind of stuff. They're probably the first ones to maybe not the exact apparatus of like weight releasers, but this idea of overloading the eccentric. So yeah, it's just down, but in my initial Bishop for sure. And then Christian Thibodeau kind of before him, and then way back, like Bob Hoffman, York barbell, all the old time power lifters, like you're saying. Yeah.
Do you group them? Because I would imagine the height of it based on the player that's using them, you have to group them at a rack, same height, or otherwise you're spending a lot of time messing with the length of the releaser, right?
Exactly. So we'll, by rack, you know, like we try to have every, like the racks based off height. And then by that, we kind of, set the weight releaser to like that set height. So the only thing that has to change is like the weight on and off it. Because like you're saying, it takes a lot of time already. So to like have to also adjust the heights of the weight releaser would probably make it pointless. Now there's some discrepancies, you know, like for some kids it's perfect. For some kids it's maybe too long or too short by an inch or two. And hey, it's fine. You know, it's not going to be perfect. But yeah, we'll kind of set the height per the rack, and the rack is based off the height, and then so we don't have to adjust the heights. And I'll try to like, I just really like guesstimate it, you know, and like trial it through the warm up, like if we need to adjust these, but after that, like we don't touch them, and we'll keep it the same for that semester.
And is it kind of 20 degrees on a squat wedge sweet spot, or you're looking usually a 120 to 130% for the eccentric overload with the weight releasers? Or I know you've got it prescribed, and you had a great PDF that has some weight releaser information, but is that kind of the sweet spot for that?
Yeah, I think the squat wedge is very relative to the individual. Some's 20, some's like just a heel, you know. But the weight releasers, we kind of all start them out like where it's honestly just 90%. But remember, we're doing that maybe for like 4 sets of 5 total reps with that 90% on the eccentric. So it's only 90 on the bar, but for 5 reps, it's tough. You're obviously not doing that via the concentric. But that's like the first introduction, you know, it's still submaximal, relative to the concentric, but, for 5 reps is definitely not. And then from there, we're just slowly work up to hopefully ending around 120% between like an 8-week period of starting at 90 and ending at 120. The weight on the barbell for us stays pretty constant, you know, 70 to 75% max on the bar for that period. So the concentric weight doesn't change really ever. But the only thing that we're progressing over time is the weight on the weight releasers. So working from 90 to 120 is a 30% jump, you know, over time. And for some kids, you know, like it's even more because they're adapting so much faster. So again, that also becomes relative, you know, like based off of their skill and, like just what we're seeing as it's happening, you know, like I never want to hold kids back. So if there's a session of we're at 120%, let's say like a kid has like 205 on the barbell, but 315 on the lower, and it's crushing it, you know, they're doing their 6-second lower for 3 reps maybe. And it looks great. You know, I'm not going to hold them back. Like we'll bump it up to 140 if they can handle it. you know. But from that standpoint, I've never like planned to go over 120%. Could they handle it? Maybe, but just time being the limiting factor, we haven't gotten past 120.
Yeah, and for those, I guess, that have never seen a weight releaser, obviously you can only perform one repetition.
Yeah.
With that overloaded eccentric, and then I guess you prescribe the following reps.
Yeah.
Progressively, and the heavier the eccentric overload is, I guess the fewer reps they do once the weight is released.
Yeah, sure. So we'll usually work from down from 5 to 3 in total concentric reps. I've never done more than 3 with the weight releasers on. So for example, if we're doing like this 4x5 at 90, it'll be like a cluster of 2 plus 2 plus 1. So the start of each cluster will have that weight releaser. So that first cluster of 2, the first rep is the weight releaser, then the concentric, and then another rep without the weight releaser, and then the concentric, then the racket. And then we'll reattach the weight releaser and then repeat. So they have 3 reps of that overloaded eccentric and then 5 total concentric reps. And then maybe the next progression or later progression might be like 6 sets of 3, but all 3 reps again have that weight releaser. So now there's no eccentric reps without an overload. And this might be the point in time where we're at like 120. So all 3 reps have 120% on the lower, but again, maybe only 70 to 75 on the concentric. Because again, that's the emphasis for us, is that overloading that eccentric. But yeah, over time, I've never done less than 3, and I've never done more than 5. That's kind of just my, I'm sure I'll change maybe next semester, but in the few semesters we've done it, no more than 5, no less than 3. It's kind of the sweet spot. I'd love to get to a point where we're getting like really crazy. Maybe it's just like one singular rep for like 8 to 10 seconds on a lower, with like a really super max, you know. But I mean, who knows?
And if you were back in time at Midwestern or Tennessee Tech, and you look at your budget, you're like, crap, I can't afford these.
Yeah.
It would take trust and communication, but could you do a poor man version and have some links outside the collars and like a strip set after the eccentric?
I'm not a big fan of the strip setup, because I feel like it's got to be like a NASCAR pit crew. Like you're taking it off at the same time, or like some kid takes it off and the bar's leaning, you know, like that's probably worst case scenario. I think the best poor man's way is probably a Hatfield style, where if you have a safety bar and the handles, you know, the only thing you'd have to do is instead of having no Hatfield on the lower. So hands are on the bar on the lower, and then you attach the hands on the handle and the concentric. Now, it's really hard to justify the discrepancy between, is it like adding the hands, does it make it 70%? You know, like I don't really know, but at least it adds more stability. You know, like when you have more stability, it's going to be a lot easier. So in my experience, like the easiest way is probably going to be Hatfield style on the lower, and then attaching the hands on the concentric. But even that, you know, there's inherent risk. It's hard to really like periodize exact percentages with that style. I think the best way, if you don't have weight releasers, is just to do the pure eccentric and bail into the safeties, maybe front loaded, whether it's a front squat or a Zercher, just from like a safety standpoint. If you really want to overload the eccentric, I just think logistically and safety, that's probably the best way. If not, the Hatfield's great if they're technically sound and experienced in that. But I'm not a fan of the strip, because I just think I know like kid
really bad in a large group setting. But to your point, that's not a bad idea. If you really wanted to do it, you had a double sided rack, eccentric dump, walk around to the other side with the 75%, and then do concentric reps. It could be kind of a little cumbersome and clunky, but if you really wanted to do it, you could make
exactly.
GoFundMe for some weight releasers or car wash or something. Partial range of the motion, seeing them with the squat. How do you determine, or do you work, I guess, isometrics? You know, the negative is the range of motion, but if you work, do you work different ranges of motion, or did you find one that you're like, this is the area we need to work an isometric at?
Yeah, I think with like, it depends on the time of year. It's like our off season. We'll try to bias like the probably the most disadvantageous position, which is probably going to be the end range, the lengthened position, where like we use a squat, for example. Honestly, like we're just trying to develop the squat because all of our like fancy stuff is out of the squat. So we need the squat to be as proficient as possible. So like with the, like an overcoming isometric, maybe for example, early in our off season or late in our off season, I should clarify, is like, we'll do an overcoming isometric, but instead of like the top range, like we're doing the very bottom, like maximizing knee flexion where you're probably the weakest. So we can obviously inherently bridge that gap and get like as simple as it is, get your weakest position stronger. To obviously like the bottom of the squat's gonna be the weakest, you know. So why not just get in the bottom and overload the concentric with an overcoming isometric? And that's not like nuanced, like that's again more an advanced powerlifter kind of deal. But like we will go like with the same idea, but maybe we're working like within the set, like the full range. So like set one is the bottom. And then like set two, maybe your mid-range, 90 degrees, and then set three, you're the top and the strongest, you know? So we're exposing still that full range of motion, but to that overcoming isometric and overloading those positions. And then as we get closer to like right now, for example, like our in-season, and like where you still have to work like general to specific, you know, range of motion still, or maybe we're working like in the top range of motion now. And doing like an overcoming isometric and complexing it with like a jump or a plyometric, you know. So it's really just time of year dependent. Early in the off season, a lot deeper ranges, a lot more time. And then now, like where we're playing or preseason, it's shallower ranges, less time, higher force, maybe complexing it, you know.
And then Ian, what's the shortest amount of an overcoming isometric and what's the longest? Because I guess you kind of have to plan it out or periodize it.
Yeah.
Those ranges.
I like to do 6 seconds as our shortest because I think there's like a ramping time. You know, you're not going to go 0 to 100 immediately. It's probably going to be the first 1 to 2 seconds before you get to 100. And then you could probably hold that for 3 seconds, maybe 4, you know. But you want to get to that threshold where you're at 100 and it starts to like deviate down, you know, you don't want to leave any juice to squeeze. So I think 6 seconds is a good point to ramp to 100 and then hold it for as long as possible when you're doing it at 100%. And then we've done like in our off season, like I was saying, in that bottom position, we've done it for 20 seconds, you know, where obviously you're not going to push for 100% for 20, but maybe we're trying to maintain 70% for 20 seconds, you know, because again, we're trying to strengthen that bottom position and maybe create awareness. So 20% or 20 seconds for 70%, like that's tough. Like at the end of the day, we're just trying to create awareness. So usually 6 to 20 is kind of the time frame, obviously 6 being the most intense from how hard you're pushing to 20 being the less.
Okay, no, that's great. All this talk so far has kind of been lower body and yeah. I've seen some chin up eccentrics and things, but let's talk like upper body striking power, the ability to just hammer that ball and put it in someone's face on the opposite side of that and crush them. What are you doing to develop the upper body? Is it the same approach? Weight releasers, what are we doing for upper body power?
So it's a little different, like for my upper body, like I just value the chin up like you're saying. So similar ideas without the weight releaser, overloading the eccentric, but more so like from a health standpoint, first and foremost, everything's from a health standpoint. It doesn't matter if they're not playing. So like with the shoulder, for example, it's complex. There's a lot of intricacies and a lot of movements, you know. So within like things that are probably going to yield the most, like from a range of motion standpoint or involvement of things, like I think the chin up is probably the best because just the amount of range of motion the humerus goes through and the shoulder blades, it's a lot, you know. So that's going to yield a big adaptation. So I value the chin up. And then from the standpoint of like females being able to do like a full chin up properly is pretty rare. So it's a big deal from a relative strength standpoint when a female can do a full chin up and with quality, you know, even a weighted chin up. Like anecdotally, like there's not much correlation, but our best athletes, like from a female standpoint, can do a full chin up. And it says a lot from like your nervous system standpoint to even your body composition. Those are all players. So we value the chin up for a lot of reasons. And then, you know, it's, after that, like we're not doing any really advanced methods like the squat. Like keep it really simple with the upper body for females. Chin ups, push ups, overhead pressing. and then like remedial work on the shoulder. It's nothing you've never seen before. We'll apply tempos, you know, in the same way, but not as advanced as with the squat. I think for like specificity wise and like hitting the ball hard or fast is more so technical. So like throwing, I like throwing the football, you know, plyo ball is a very baseball thing, but success leaves clues. Like those dudes throw heat. It's not very different, you know, so taking those traits from baseball with plyo balls and applying it with volleyball, like directly, like again, general to specific, that's very specific, with that skill of hitting and throwing. So yeah, upper body is a lot simpler. The chin up's a little advanced, but then the throwing stuff's a little different, but not really reinventing the wheel there.
Do you use medicine balls a lot with your team?
Yeah, not a ton of like rotational throwing stuff like you would think. I think with that, like going back to hitting and throwing, I just try to get as specific as possible with that technical skill, the arm swing, because that's, you know, there's a learned skill there, and then, like, you have to be efficient. So I think that's why throwing, we just go right to throwing, you know, like, I feel like our best, like, hitters, I don't want to say best hitters, our most efficient, like, arm swings have pretty good arms throwing, you know, and there's something to that. But with the med ball stuff, yeah, we'll use med balls, like, we'll obviously do some slams. We like the, I really am a big advocate of, like, using the torso through, like, big ranges of motion, like the spine. So like a prone throw where you're extending over a med ball on your back and throwing it, like, again, a very baseball thing, you know, things like that, you know, some Ched, we'll get into a point now where we're like, we're complexing like a chin up with that throw or a push up with like a partner chest pat, like very, you know, very simple things. We're just creating outputs. Nothing crazy there.
Last question, and then I'll pass it on to Blake. Hypothetical, the AD comes into your office today and says, hey coach, I'm switching you to women's basketball. What would look different and what would look the same in your training?
Honestly, I think probably most all of it, like within the weight room, would be the same. Like at the end of the day, like training's training. It's going to yield probably a similar adaptation, but how you use it specifically is what's different. Like at the end of the day, it's just the engine, refining the engine, you know, like you're going to use your quads in basketball. You're going to use your torso in basketball. All those things are the same. The nuance comes in with like the throwing, probably not going to be throwing, probably going to not be working as much technical jumping. And so you replace that with, you know, training on the court via sprinting, change of direction, aerobic capacity, conditioning. Like that's the only nuance I think that's really different. But we're still going to squat the same. We're still going to do chin-ups and push-ups. Still going to put weight releasers on the bar. You know, all those things are the same because those are just general qualities. The specificity comes with, like, the throwing and the technical work on the jump. And with basketball, you know, the sprinting and the conditioning. But outside of that, not really going to change anything.
And you don't use GPS with volleyball, and I understand it. All right, you switched to women's basketball. Would you use GPS with that thing?
Yeah, I would, because I think the component of running is a little different. Like, honestly, volleyball, like, our practice, you know, it's not hard. Like, it's long, but it's not hard. It's a lot of stopping. We don't have to – it manages itself. I don't have to worry about, like, doing too much. Honestly, most of the times you don't do enough. But vice versa, on basketball historically does too much all the time. It's a year-round. Like, they're always playing. And running's a little bit different of a monster. You know, the change of direction is a lot more wear and tear over time than some things. So, and their lifestyle factors are a lot more, they're terrible in relative to volleyball. You know, they don't take care of themselves the same way as volleyball athletes. So you have to manage them at a different degree. So I would use like a catapult or polar, something along Connexon, something along those lines. And honestly, it just gives constraints to coaches, you know, because like I said, they usually do too much too often. So it allows you to put constraints on them if they even want to use it.
Yeah, with basketball, it is hard to tell. Off-season, in-season, it's all a blur. It looks the same because you can play whenever you want. They will. They'd rather be on the court than in the weight room. So they don't take advantage of that. That was awesome, man. I appreciate the nuts and bolts. Now I'm going to pass it on to Blake, more kind of intern business-type feedback.
Of course.
What's up, guys? So first question, just kind of take me back to your first years of full-time paid coach. Was there something missing or an area that you feel like you could have developed more when you were interning slash GA?
Yeah, so I just didn't have like the intrapersonal skills with like coaches and support staff and admin. Like that's a people person's a skill. You just have to do it. And like, I think time, it only gets better with time. So it's hard to like in like an intern position, you know, develop those intricacies with coaches. You're probably not going to be in that position. But you can, you know, with like your supervisors and like, you know, ask them questions on situations. So like, you know, I was never exposed to, and it's hard too, like those hard conversations with coaches if they're unhappy with something, like how are you going to react or how do you respond in a way they can understand and not like piss them off more, you know, or like being very like have a solution ready. Because honestly, that in my experience, most coaches just like they know there's a problem. They just want to know if you have the answer. They don't want to know why there's a problem. They just want to know if you're going to fix it. So like being able to have a solution as fast as possible, that's another like skill, I think, and like unless you're exposed to it, it's hard to really know. And I don't really have the answer to like figure that out within like your role as an intern outside of just asking these coaches you're around now, like in their experiences in those situations, because that first one, man, it sneaks up on you and it's tough. But you're only better for it and you learn from it. So yeah, the interpersonal skills, like developing how to communicate with head coaches, because it's different. You know, like all head coaches are head coaches for a reason, and they're pretty crazy, and they're all crazy in their own facets. So knowing that they're crazy and knowing how to manipulate how you talk to them is a skill in itself.
Have you found that when you make them think it's their own ideal, that usually works better?
Oh, for sure. My head coach now, like she's so into like social media scene things, and she'll ask like, are we doing these things, or what do you think of these things, would it be good for us to do these things? I'm like, yeah, we already do this, we might not be doing it. She doesn't come in the weight room, she has like no idea what we do on a day-to-day, which is great, like she stays out of the way, but like she's, you know, she's into it, and it's like, yeah for sure, we'll do that, you know, and never do it.
All right, so when you're first getting started, you kind of seek out a certain, you know, coach or a program that aligned with your philosophies, or was it just a first job you found, take it, and did you try to be more selective when you advanced in your career?
I think like as time went on, very much more selective. But I didn't know anything, so I had other people kind of luckily guide me in that direction early. So my first internship when I was at Midwestern State, those GAs, two of the three GAs had been interns at TCU prior. So once I graduated and my time came, they're like, this would be like a great opportunity, like push me into that direction. I had no idea. Like I had no idea what a strength and conditioning internship at like one of these programs entailed outside of like what I had been exposed to at that small division like two. And it's a monster, you know, and luckily, like, I didn't know. I think it was good that I had no idea, because I would have, like, you know, judged things and, like, thought I had new things, and I didn't. So, luckily, early, like, I had those people guide me into that, and then vice versa at TCU, like, when I'm searching for a GA, luckily, like, Zach Dakin, he's great. At the time, Steve Gephardt was the men's basketball strength coach. He's at Texas A&M now. Like those two guys, and along with the people I interned with, guiding me into like what's next, like from a GA standpoint, and for like getting me to understand, like it's just important to get experience, and it doesn't matter. Like getting a GA now is great, like getting the free master is great, but obviously the experience, and it does not matter where. Like just getting on the floor, like in the trenches experience. I honestly think GAing at smaller universities is more valuable than GAing at a power, because you're going to get way more time on the court and you're going to have way more responsibility outside of just coaching, from maybe even nutrition, your involvement in practices, versus like a here where you have a dietitian and like these sports scientists and you don't get any exposure to that. So under them guiding me into like, hey, a GA at a mid-major, Tennessee Tech, you know, luckily it was basketball, like jumping at that opportunity, and just trusting them. I think, again, me not knowing anything allowed me to trust them, because I wanted to be in that position. So they could have been spitting bullshit at me and I would have believed it, and they probably did. So that, yeah, early, them guiding me. And then, you know, as time goes on, I start to like develop this filter for what's right and wrong, what's BS, what's not. And then I did this GA and it was great. You know, I had a ton of experience, but, you know, like it comes a time where like this is a very, very saturated field. And, you know, like those good positions, people stay in them and they're not creating a ton of positions. So it's very far and few. So the positions that are open, you know, aren't great. So you have to have that awareness that it's not going to be a home run hire for your first full-time job. And again, it's more so like this is where like the value of what you're working with matters and like the people you're working for matters. So understanding your head coach's situation of the teams you're working with, they're like, are they just crap and they're probably going to get fired? Or are they like a young head coach and they're winning a lot and there's a chance for them to move on? Can you ride that coattail with them? Vice versa, like the directors of those departments, what's their history of like, where do their former assistants and interns go on? Do they have a tree and network of people that go on to bigger and better things? So when you're looking for that full-time job, that first full-time, that stuff kind of matters, you know, but again, it's far and few. So honestly, like any opportunity you have, is probably going to be a great opportunity. That's when you start looking into more of those things, you know, once like money starts coming into the equation because you do have a livelihood and that matters. So doing your research on the coaches you're working for and those departments and where those people went to is a big deal. And then obviously like at this point in time, I would hope you start like niching yourself in the direction you want to go from like a sport you want to work with. Do you want to be football? Do you want to be an Olympic director? Do you want to work with basketball? Do you want to work with women's baseball? You know, that's like, then those decisions also matter. Cause like, if you want to work with baseball and you take a position for women's golf and tennis, because it says Illinois on the logo, you know, that's not a smart move, for your career, like 5 years down the road. But if you take a baseball position at a Division II, but you also have to assist football and five other sports, that's probably a great job, because you have baseball and you're overseeing a baseball program and you're also getting a ton of experience elsewhere. So just having that awareness, you know, like when that time comes to really evaluate those positions and not get caught up in the logos, because there's a lot of really crappy Power Four positions, that don't pay crap, because the people jump at those logos and they don't have to pay people because they know they're going to fill them. So those positions will always stay crappy. Vice versa, like these smaller programs, mid majors, Division II, Division III, like, those are some really good programs, and there's directors that stay there for a long time for a reason. So don't be discouraged by the logo. It's the situation of the people that matter more than anything.
I'm just curious, how old are you? You have the wisdom of an older man.
No. I luckily I've been in a lot of places in a short amount of time. I'm 30. I think I was really lucky with really good people around me. And my parents to like raise me in a way where I can evaluate things in my environment. We just had this talk with our team, like awareness, I think is a really great tool to have. Self-awareness, environmental awareness, you know, emotional awareness, all facets of awareness is, Highland Park, Dallas, Texas, probably one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the world. And like these people we interact with every day, like, they have a shit ton of awareness, like self-awareness, and they know how to interact with people at a high level. Success leaves clues everywhere, sport or life, you know? So that's one facet I try to take from these people I interact with day to day that are really, really rich and well off, is they have a lot of awareness of themselves and the people around them. So I think you can apply that within these situations as well.
That's great advice and discernment.
I appreciate it.
Everybody needs to hear that wants to get into this business. And yeah, that's what benefits so many different people. Well, you got any other intern thoughts? We're passing it on to.
We can probably pass on that.
Ashley for a rapid fire, and then we'll wrap it up with one open question.
All right, I have one question. In the entire world, if you could coach with one coach, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Yeah, I saw this question and I was thinking about it yesterday and I never thought about it. And I really thought hard because the answer I'm going to give you, I did not want to give this answer because it's so like whatever. So I would choose Charles Poliquin because most all of my methodologies and like my mentors have some influence there. And from what I understand of like the people I worked for, like he's a very intelligent, like logical individual. And obviously he puts out, there's a ton of resources out there from him. And he's like, you know, some people don't think highly of him. Like it's fine. You know, I think like Ben Patrick and like the knees over toes stuff have kind of put a negative stain on that style of training, because honestly, everything Ben Patrick does is just Charles Poliquin, like structural balance for medial training. Like he's just taken that and like systemized it and sold it. But that's just very basic, like Poliquin-esque training. But it's much more than that, you know, from like a nutrition standpoint and a lifestyle standpoint that he was elite at. So I would, you know, love to be able to pick his brain, because the people I've worked for have talked very highly of him, and how I train with some things is very Poliquin-esque.
Yeah. And he is no longer with us, if I'm not mistaken, but yep. He still has books. That's one thing I love about this is, I don't try to go live in an echo chamber or confirmation bias. I don't know anything about squat wedges. I've heard you and several other mentioned Christian Thibodeau's books. I've never read those, but I've got them on my list. So that's Charles. I've never read any of his books, but that's something I should add to my list. And that's a great question. And actually, great answer.
Had me thinking about it.
he works with a lot of bodybuilders, too. There's a lot of
Yeah, a lot of bodybuilding, a lot of like Olympic, like throwing, track and field kind of deals.
Was he American? It seems like most of the greats were not.
French Canadian.
Yeah.
So, like Thibodeau's Canadian. There's, I don't know, Canada. They must have something going on. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the guy that did the French contrast method before Cal Deets, I think he was a Canadian track coach. Right. I think there's more Olympic medals, but I don't know. I don't know.
Hey.
Maybe we're better thieves and we steal their knowledge.
Exactly.